If there's one subject you could write 800 pages on, it would probably be transcendence. And this person has done just that.
I do think that the transcendental is so abiding because it's always the thing that meets us from moment to moment as beings. It's because at every instant that I feel like I have some connection to what my imminent material conscious life is like, I'm being faced with the question of what is not that thing and not that experience.
David LaRocca on a huge idea, owned in part by religion and in part by philosophy. But does philosophy really have a place at the table? Isn't it a religious idea? In the Philosopher's Zone, here's Eleanor Gordon-Smith on the art of going beyond.
A while ago, a friend of mine told me that he was embarking on a transcendental meditation workshop, and it made me wonder, when Kant or Plato or Aristotle wrote on transcendence, was that what they had in mind? What do we talk about when we talk about transcendence? We're going to answer that question in two parts. Today, we're speaking to Professor David LaRocca about the ancients. Why is ancient geometry transcendent? Is God a word for the transcendent? And what would ancient philosophers have said about transcending your body? In part two, we'll talk about where transcendence went after the Enlightenment and how one philosopher is trying to achieve it personally and sometimes illegally. But for now, here's David LaRocca, who started working on this because he, like us, couldn't find a simple definition for transcendence.
Well, the funny thing is that the transcendental is one of these things that's so prevalent that it's sort of always there in front of us, and so it's harder to see. In some ways, the transcendental as a concept is both essential and in some ways impossible to cover. The heft of the volume gives some indication of that. Even with 800 plus pages, there still was a lot left to say. The idea is that this is meant to be a collection of indelible responses by philosophers, theologians, and writers to essential questions that we ask about reality, being, and the nature and limits of human knowledge. The concept of the transcendental ranges over all of these major categories of philosophical inquiry, and it also, because of the nature of the history of thought, often evolves out of religious traditions, literary traditions, including poetry and other kinds of texts, not just, say, a classical Greek dialogue or a 19th century sermon, but a journal entry, excerpts from novels, essays, treatises, lectures, letters, and so on.
Do you think there's a reason that the theme of the transcendental has preoccupied so many people in so many different areas? I mean, that's a wide range of people. You've got creative types and religious types and philosophers and scientists. Is there a reason that it's of such wide interest to so many sorts of people?
I think that whenever we come up with a concept that is capacious enough to handle the things we don't know, then that concept gets invoked quite a lot. So a popular word we might run to think of is God. And God is in some ways as large a concept as we can make it, because we're constantly adding to what we mean when we say God and so on. So I think the transcendental is not necessarily equal to God, but it is in similar territory. Often it becomes a kind of space or conceptual territory for us to refer to things like the ineffable. But at the same time, one of the ambitions of the collection was to emphasize the writers who see the transcendental in the everyday.
I want to take us back to the ancient view of transcendence. One question is that a term that they use? Do they speak in the terminology of transcendence, or is it something closer to God or the sublime? Is there a question about translation there when you're working with these ancient texts?
Very much so. Translation is very much at the forefront of my mind, because we are, in this particular book, we're engaging almost exclusively in English, but from sometimes works that have been translated multiple times through other languages. You'll find in, say, ancient Greek and Roman texts, equivalencies, proximities between words like being and God and maybe the ineffable. But again, of course, I'm speaking English. So unless we explore the etymology of the Greek words that are actually in the texts, then we're still just sort of paraphrasing.
In pursuit of that, I'm going to turn to the original text, but regrettably, the only way I can do that is in English, for me at least.
Yes.
So I'm looking at one of the excerpts that you have. It's Plato and Phaedo. It's on 51, if you wanted to follow along at home.
Sure.
The audiobook. Yeah, there's this passage where we say, "And we were not saying long ago that the soul, when using the body as an instrument of perception, that is to say, when using the sense of sight or hearing or some other sense, were we not saying that the soul too is then dragged by the body into the region of the changeable and wanders and is confused, the world spins around her, and she is like a drunkard when she touches change." That's a remarkable passage. And this is meant to be a warning, right? This is meant to be that we're not supposed to use our bodily perception as our only tool for gaining knowledge.
I think that this passage is representative of Greek thought, or at least, let's say, concerns that are prevalent in Greek thought in a broad sense. But one of the tricks and difficulties of reading Plato is that we, of course, are in some sense in a dramatic work. We're in the midst of a dialogue, and we're not always sure what the ambition of, let's say, in our modern vernacular, the author means for us to take away. What I'm picking up, for example, when I read this is, what is the preoccupation with the distinction, the assumed distinction between the soul and the body, which does seem widespread in Hellenic culture.
Right, but this is a transcendent question in some senses, isn't it? If the thought is that using the body as an instrument of perception mires us in this realm where we get things wrong and we get confused and we take knowledge to be only those things that the body knows, is that setting us up for the idea that we can transcend the body, that transcendence becomes an escape from the physical in some sense?
Mm. One of the difficulties, I think, for a present address to this ancient question is what we know now and how that interrupts what we can think about in these ancient texts. For example, if you have some intimacy with current cognitive science and theories of how brains and bodies function, then this ancient text may seem more like a parable or a metaphor, and therefore its relevance is more historical or even poetic, and not a guide to understand how transcendence or the transcendent functions in everyday life. Let me give an example. So for a lot of brain scientists, there is just a continuity between body and mind. In fact, we want to maybe bracket or even put in quotation marks the word soul, because this is going to push us out of the territory of brain science. But something like consciousness might be a more comfortable word for neurologists and neuroscientists to think about. And consciousness would be understood as a biological process. So in that sense, it is very imminent. It is, although we can have thoughts about Plato and the transcendent, we are doing it through a biochemical process. I wonder, you know, whether these kinds of contemporary interventions interrupt our ability to think through or think with ancient philosophers and writers.
Do you feel like you can go with these ancient philosophers with their concepts when you read this?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Or, partly I'm just sort of endlessly fascinated and captivated by this, what seems to be something like a through line. I think that similar to the way we engage fiction, there is something like a willing suspension of disbelief. So to enter into the world of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle does mean to suspend a certain amount of knowledge or information or history, to sort of walk with them. And that can be a pretty profound experience to attempt to read with. Of course, reading at the same time with tremendous ignorance. So we come back again to the text itself, working with the text. And I, you know, your experience, the way that you spoke animatedly about reading that passage, to me is a great indication of this.
Professor David LaRocca on the modern challenges of reading ancient works. So, if our thought and language are so different, can we find transcendence as we know it in works 2,000 years old?
I'm going to give you a reading of like why I think that these texts are so dense in transcendence, like why they embody some kind of transcendental thought. I'm talking of the Socratic dialogues here.
Okay.
Obviously, you agree that these texts have something to do with transcendence because you've put them in a volume about transcendence, but I want to run by you why I think that is and then tell me if you think that's right. So I think the central preoccupation that we have here is a question of the limits of bodily perception and of how much the knowledge that we gain from our senses and from what's immediately apparent is a genuine guide to reality or to knowledge or to, I guess, like the world or the truth. And I think there's a really palpable preoccupation with the idea that it's not, and that we need to find a way to break free of the constraints imposed on us by flesh and the limits of perception. Does that sound right to you? Tell me if it's wrong. If it's wrong, it'll be interesting.
Well, not so much wrong as I'm still processing it, but you have prompted me to reflect on a couple of things. You know, in the West, we tend to think in binaries. This is part of the inheritance of Western philosophy and religion. And likewise, your invocation of body and soul has a similar kind of strict division. One of the classic qualities of the body, of course, is mortality and decay and dissipation. And with the soul, one hopes, one imagines that it's eternal and it's everlasting. But one of the interesting attributes of the writers that we have here, at least some of these writers, is that they trouble that. And there are many attempts to take these terms and concepts that seem rarefied and that are, we might say, beyond proof, and to have the transcendental come into the experience of the everyday.
Is that combination between the everyday and this, I'm going to say otherworldly realm, but I don't mean that in the binary sense. Is that something that's a relatively recent contribution to transcendental thought, or do you see origins of that as far back as the Socratic dialogues?
I see it as far back and even earlier. And it's likely, I mean, given the things one can read in the Anthropology of Religion, I would guess that we're talking here on the scale of hundreds of thousands of years. And I can see this also, you know, in my own daughters who are very young, you know, they seem equipped to address the transcendental in ways that philosophy itself as a word seems to carry. You know, philosophy is the love of wisdom, but it's also in some sense, it begins in awe. That to me is the fundamental spirit of a philosophical outlook, is to behold and hear in a full sense of that, not just a visual sense, but a bodily sense, a cognitive sense, an emotional sense. Oftentimes, the accounts that my 5-year-old or 11-year-old daughters will give are much more nuanced and insightful than anything that one's philosophical or scientific training can do, at least when it comes to that moment of awe or perception. So what's being tapped into, to me, that's where I'm trying to pick up on this ancient concern or awareness. So, you know, to come back to your question and to the thought, I do think that the transcendental is so abiding because it's always the thing that meets us from moment to moment as beings. That's why I'm describing the book as this reflection in part on the nature of being, because one could say that the transcendent is non-being, right? Or that it's ultimate being of some other type. So just as a quick reference, if we are not gods, then what is the nature of the gods or God? This would seem to be either non-being or some alternate kind of being with other qualities, and that has a long history. But that's what I mean by it abides, because at every instant that I feel like I have some connection to what my imminent material conscious life is like, I'm being faced with the question of what is not that thing and not that experience.
I feel like I have an obligation to ask if you have an example in mind of where your daughters have been more interesting and insightful than philosophers might be.
Well, it happens every day. I mean, it's tremendous. It's often too, I'd say it, the way that it expresses itself best is in their grammar, especially when they're younger. My 11-year-old is now incredibly literate and reads more books than I do. So she's kind of graduated into the realm of rational cultural discourse. But the 5-year-old is, and this is what I mean by the grammar of it, she will phrase things in odd ways. She will conjugate, she will add words and orders that don't come to mind. But it's that messiness and mixed upness that provides these great moments of insight. I wish I could. I mean, I have written them down, but I don't have them ready to hand because they're so hard to recreate. You know, when she says them, I think, I'll remember that, but I don't, because it's not how my own language experience manifests itself. I've been trained out of thinking sideways. The rewards of communication with human beings continue to be the rewards of reason convincing people, not befuddling them. So because my 5-year-old doesn't have that preoccupation, she's liberated. And this gives her an ability to speak unselfconsciously and to, without knowing it, essentially experiment with the way that her world is framed. For that reason, she sees things I don't see.
So it's interesting that you speak of your daughter ascending to a realm of rational discourse. It's interesting that you invoke realms, because one thing I wanted to talk about was the realm of the Platonic form and whether this is an idea that contains a densely transcendental thought. I remember it was rendered in geometric terms, so we had the idea that that there's somewhere a realm that contains the Platonic form of a circle. And all we can do here on Earth is render imperfect circles that are a wee bit wonky or have, you know, disjointed bits from our flawed penciling, or even if we did them digitally, they'd be rendered flawed by pixels, and that all we're doing down here in this muddy realm is trying to instantiate that Platonic form of a circle, and that distinction can be applied to things like beauty as well, that somewhere up there there's a Platonic form of beauty that we are just instantiating flawed versions of.
I think that's a very useful how do I want to finish that sentence, story or definition, because the question is whether it's an account that is literally the case or whether it's meant to be analogical. So what I mean is many people who have some experience with Plato think of him as an idealist. And the word idealism gives you the indication that, oh, we're speaking of ideas and ideals. And so your definition and your example are very useful. We think there is an idea of a perfect circle. This exists, say, in my mind or as a projection of my mental capacity. And then there are all the imperfect circles that we create with pens and ink and so on. Another reading is to say that Plato is not an idealist at all, or to reframe it, he is what's called a classical realist. And this is tremendously disorienting. But the notion is that for Plato, the circle does exist. It is a real thing.
Is that a transcendental thought, the distinction between realms defined by perfection and imperfection?
Yeah, I think that's the spirit of where these things, let's call them geometry and mathematics, is wonderful for this, and it was this way for the Greeks as well for Immanuel Kant. They're wonderful because they exude a kind of potential for perfection. 5 + 7 = 12, right? Kant's example, and it just has this wonderful eternal quality. And in a maybe a lowercase t, we can call that a transcendent quality because it transcends time. It's an atemporal truth. It was the same for Pythagoras as for me. And that in itself is a remarkable collapse of temporal experience. Meanwhile, where does the reality of 5 + 7 = 12 exist? What are we talking about? And then it seems like we've shifted into the capital T, transcendent. Is it not here? Is it not on earth? Is it not? And then we have to kind of work our way down the list. Is it not in my brain? Is it not in the cultural memory of Western mathematics or global mathematics? Something like this.
You ask a really interesting question in the introduction, which is, do we use the term transcendent to refer to that which is most real or that which is least real? Do you have an answer now?
I don't. Not a quick one. I mean, that's partly why I wrote the introduction, was to try to at least put out on the table the kinds of questions that I think the transcendental elicits from readers and from me as I put together the book, and not so much to settle things. It's more of an observation. What if we sometimes get things exactly wrong, which is very common and frequent for me, to get things precisely the opposite position that I'm aiming for? A lot of conventional thought, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, I just mean that the kind of way that we generally customarily speak about transcendental things tends to be to say they are beyond us in some form or fashion, and thus that we're left with an existence that's just the detritus, and it's not the important thing. The important thing is the everlasting soul. The important thing is the Godhead and the knowledge of the forms or something like this. But if we invert that to reverse our thinking or question our thinking about where we're placing our emphasis and our value, and that by turning the transcendent toward the everyday, we may be in a position to find new and higher value in that experience.
David LaRocca of Binghamton University on transcendence in the everyday. His 800-page anthology collects what's been said about transcendence from Plato to Zizek, and there's a whole heap in between. So we're not quite done yet with transcendence. In our next program, someone else who's spent time thinking about the great going beyond and what that might mean in the modern day, where transcendence isn't what it used to be. And if you're interested in such themes as transcendence, you can't go past The Spirit of Things with Rachel Conn. You might know the program on the RN schedule. It comes up just after the Philosopher's Zone on the linear schedule on Sunday afternoons, but you can also download it as a pod, just like the Philosopher's Zone. And in recent episodes, Rachel has looked at what's behind Buddha's smile, indigenous spirituality, and an inspiring in-depth interview with Krista Tippett of On Being fame. You might know that program. It's that other great pod which looks at questions of transcendence in all its humanly manifestations. The Spirit of Things with Rachel Conn. Get it where you would normally go for your podcasts. Thanks to Eleanor Gordon-Smith, I'm Joe Gelonesi, and you've been in The Philosopher's Zone.